You're listening to Like Mother, Like Son on WJFF.
And that's my mother, Patricia Adams.
And that's my son, Ramsey Adams.
The show is like Mother, Like Son?
Yes.
That's right, with
really?
The question mark.
With a question mark.
You know, it's a mother's son thing. Welcome to Like Mother, Like Son. This is my son, Ramsey Adams.
And that's my mother, Patricia Adams. We're with Amy Gillingham, who, among many things, is an off-the-grid liver.
A high
Her
liver.
Her liver is off the grid. So you live on a farm called Wild Roots that's off of Chandelier, and it is completely off the grid. Meaning there's no electricity.
Correct.
And that's, believe it or not, pretty unique these days.
For around here, yeah. And we have part of our driveway is a half a mile long, so you know, that was it wouldn't even make sense for us to try to bring power lines down there. But even if it did, Wes, my husband, and myself made a conscious choice to live without that and use the appropriate technologies.
Yes, that's what we want to talk about tonight, Amy, and I want to kind of frame it around the fact that Ramsey and I had dinner with Amy and Wes and their children, Iris and Ron, last week and went to their farm. And, you know, great stories are written and based on meals like Dinner with Andre and Babette's Feast. And I think that the dinner we had with you and Wes, Amy, is sort of emblematic of the choice you've made. And you're right. We drove up. It was sort of a stormy night. We went down a half a mile driveway into a clearing that, in all honesty, I would say was more hardscrabble than rich, earthy farmland down near the river. So tell us a little bit about that choice of that land that must challenge you to raise things there. It's pretty rocky.
It's very marginal soil, as much of the hilltop soil in Sullivan County is. That is part of the reason why we leased bottomland soil down in Youngsville to make our living growing vegetables, because after a few years having our gardens there, we realized that was not tillable land. But there is other things that can be done with the land, and many blueberries will grow. There's certain hardy things that do survive on these lands. We just need to learn how to manage them and work with that, and using the ecosystem as a model of what's already growing there and how can we try to produce there for ourselves and some extra to sell. Because as we learned with the river bottom soil, there's also the consequences of flooding.
Oh, you learned that?
Mm-hmm. So it's amazing working in the two opposite soils, but you're right. In looking at that, it's, you know, definitely the classic two rocks for every soil.
Now, right. on your land down in Youngsville, along the riverbank there, you were growing. I say organic, but that's not actually how you would classify it. But it's
organic. It's just we weren't certified organic. We just, with the political things that were happening and with the USDA getting involved in the certification process, we chose not to do that and to we did what we called a farmer's pledge through the Northeast Organic Farmers Association and opened our farm up to our community-supported agriculture members to visit, and if they had any questions, and that was how we basically certified mm-hmm. ourselves.
But all those years of building up that topsoil was swept away in the flood.
Right. About two-thirds of the field was, yes, because of the timing of the planting, and we'd just planted everything, so there weren't roots to really hold it in. So it makes you, you know, reevaluate and look at things, and I think we're seeing, you know, the positive after a year. We're seeing the positive of what we can do up on the hill with animals, with some different greens.
Your passion is plants, right? As opposed to trees or...
Well, you know what, I do tend to gravitate to the plants, the ground level. Wes is a tree person, and so he goes towards the trees.
How did you educate yourself? Because one of the things that I've learned about you is you really know what is there in the wild and then how to incorporate that into your meals.
Could I just say, speaking of meals, and then, Amy, I want you to answer Ramsey's question, but when we got there, you and your two children had collected fiddlehead ferns that you served with pasta, which was absolutely delicious, and then you also had some greens that you had grown, and then Iris had collected little violets from the field to add to the salad. I didn't realize you could eat them. But so how did you learn about what's edible and not?
I guess it was just something that drew me in. I'm not quite sure. I had a garden in high school because I was interested in it then, which was rare. But then I think once starting to get into wild places and you're hiking along in the Smoky Mountains or out west, or you see these little things blooming, and what are they?
So you taste them.
Well, no, I think first I learned to identify them and how to identify them. And then some of the books would say they're edible. Oh, well, that's really neat. Then eat it. And then all of a sudden you are reading a book in the middle of winter and there's something, you know, there's some medicine that comes from one of those plants. And so one thing leads to the next. And all of a sudden I realized that there's so much out there that is a gift that to us that we can provide for ourselves, medicine or food or just beauty. Or
Amy also made a tea, a nettle, what I call stingweed, but a nettle tea, and stingweed. You had collected that. Your hands were still filled
a little
steamy. That's right. And you said it's also medicinal, just there too, that those things grow everywhere, and yet you found a way to actually make a tea. How do you make that tea, from the leaves or the roots or...
Yeah, the whole plant, I just, you know, cut it when it's first coming up, and it's actually the stinging nettle part. The stingers are actually medicinal, because for things like hay fever, they actually can freeze dry them for that folic acid. So you get that for hay fever, that'll help. It's also high in iron. So as a tea, people use it as hair rinse. There's just all sorts of different things.
Just boil it and strain it?
Mm-hmm. You can just, that's how you make an infusion with a lot of these things. You just put it in boiling water and it steeps out the medicinal properties, and they call that an infusion or a tea, you know, depending on. So there's a lot of different things that you can do that way. So the kids helped me do it, and they follow me around, and they'll help harvest things, but they didn't like harvesting the nettles.
Now,
we didn't have gloves.
Tell us the age of your children.
Iris is 7, and Roan is 5 years old.
And you homeschool them?
Correct, yes.
And I think that's a real challenge, too, to be far away and with your and trying to farm and do all the things you're doing, and also find to teach your children at the same time.
Yes, but so much of what I'm doing is the teaching process for them right now. I think one of the reasons, the big reason that I'm homeschooling, is that there's so much to offer them when you're living on the farm and when you're outdoors so much of the time, because I'm not the only teacher. I mean, the whole outdoors is their you know, classroom. And they really love discovering and playing out there. And I think when they're this young, one of the most important things that we can do for children is connect them, help them develop that relationship with the natural world. Because if it isn't developed when it's really young, sometimes they don't get that relationship. So above all else, I just, it's not that I'm keeping them away from public schools. There's many children who do fine in that. I just think that there's so much to offer right now for them, and, you know, hopefully educating them to make their own decisions. And if that's something they want to go into the public school system or, you know, and try that. But right now, they have these passions that they're able to really follow through with.
Could I just describe the view of your children as we came in? It was quite wonderful. We drove in, and they were running around barefoot through this sort of rocky soil, and they couldn't wait to show me the hen house where Iris crept in and captured a little bantam rooster that sort of had webbed feet, I think. And then they leapt over fences, ran through the soil, and then they showed us your prized cattle. They took me up to the lamb pasture and explained the lamb were sick, so they weren't sure if they would be cured. I mean, they're really practical as well as meadow children. And you said, I just can't really see putting them on the bus at 7:20 in the morning and having them sit inside all day and get home at 4:20 when they can learn on this land. So I think that's true. It's really wonderful.
Yeah, and I think practical. The trick is, too, that they are loving learning and to really foster and nurture that while they're young so that it's always something that's fun. It's not something that becomes, you know, scary to them or testing or, you know, just mm-hmm. to really develop a love for that.
All right, so we're about to hear an all-acoustic piece keeping in with the theme of today's show of living off the grid. Doug Little's our musical guest. Doug, tell us about this piece.
This piece is entitled La Mezcla, which means the mix in Spanish. It's part of a four-movement suite I wrote for saxophone quartet and Cuban percussion. It was premiered at the 2003 World Saxophone Congress, and it's on my CD, Cuban Voyage, part of several original tracks I wrote inspired by Cuban music and artists.
We now return to Like Mother, Like Son with Amy Gillihan, who's living off the grid.
Tell me a little bit about the challenges and opportunities of living off the grid. I mean, for most of us, we take for granted a water pump, heat,
electricity, television,
lights, TV. So how do you keep warm without electricity in the winter without having to always build a fire?
Well, we do build fires. We build a lot of fires in the winter, but we heat with wood. We're fortunate to be able to have a finished masonry stove built in our house. So we are able to heat with the wood efficiently. We don't burn as much. We can also cook over that wood, so it serves those purposes. Plus, we can it heats our water. So we have up in our attic, we have gravity, we have bulk tanks, these barrels that we had, and it's gravity fed into the stove, so it heats our water in the winter. And we're slowly, you know, adapting the whole system to be as efficient as possible, because we know that we will get older someday. And so, you know, but I think the thing that, you know, it does take more work physically. Often, you know, we come in, that's the first thing we have to do when we come in from being gone is build a fire. You know, before we would fill kerosene lamps. Now we have our solar system, which is a huge step up. And this solar system is still much smaller than probably the average household would use. But
it provides lights.
But it provides lights. We can actually, I mean, on a sunny day, we can run blenders. I could run the vacuum. I could, you know, run a washing machine. And then we'll on cloudy days, there is a backup generator if we need it. It also, you know, runs our well. So we did have a well.
You do have to pump your water.
And
so
we pump. We can hand pump it, but we can also use the solar system to pump it. So in the middle of winter, you know, if we're really had 3 weeks of cloudy weather, we can have a backup system, you know, if we needed to. But, you know, to answer your question, one of the benefits to this, or the biggest benefit I find, is I think living this way has really helped keep me in the present, because everything I do, I have to be aware of it and be conscious of what needs to be done. I'm conscious of the seasons, you know, with the weather, with what I'm growing in the garden, or with how much sunlight we've had with the solar. I'm conscious of I have to go get water for the animals, and before I would go downhill and carry buckets up. So this, again, is a big improvement, but it took an hour of my day, but in a way, I got other things out of that hour in the day, too. So it wasn't just labor. If I had to go down and get a bucket of well at night before, or a bucket of water at the well before bed at night, and I didn't want to, but I go down there and all of a sudden I hear an owl, or I see an owl, or all of a sudden, you know, the clouds just kind of moved away and the stars are absolutely amazing. So there's always some other gift, and it's like, oh, I'm really glad I had to get out and do that. It kind of makes you do that, and then makes you more aware of your every, you know, minute activities.
But this certainly isn't a quote-unquote gentleman's farm. This is a real hard-working farm where you are. And many of us, certainly, I was, you know, young in the 60s, had visions of going back to the land, and romantic visions. And your vision might have been romantic, now it's reality, but you clearly have no regrets. And how did you, although, first think, I want to live on a farm off the grid?
You know, I started out, I guess I did internships. Well, I started out doing a lot of backpacking and being in just, you know, wild places and wilderness areas, and just realized it was very easy for me, and I loved just dealing with basic needs. So, okay, we have to hike from A to B and get there. We have to make sure we have our water. We have to make sure we have our food. And then you get there, set up camp, okay, so you're dry. And just all those practical things that I was dealing with, I loved it. Yeah. I didn't have to, you know, because again, it just kept me in the present and it kept me aware of everything that I was doing. So then it just made sense, and it was a very easy transition when I went to intern or apprentice on a farm up in Maine, which there are quite a few homesteads up there that kind of, you know, the leftovers of the back to landers that that held out, and there are, you know, some off the grid people, and I went and lived there, and it was, you know, pretty easy. It was not an adjustment. And then from there, I went and worked on another farm in Vermont, and we lived a mile from the road and without electricity. And it just wasn't, I don't know, it wasn't anything that I even thought about. And now it's to the point where, you know, it's surprising, you know, when you called to ask me to do this, it was like, oh, I don't, you know, I don't even think about it as being different than anything that anyone else is doing.
Amy, you are a novelty. I'm sorry.
It is a little different from most people's decisions.
So tell us about your farm animals. You've got a whole cast of characters over there, poultry, beef, sheep. So tell us about the animals that you have and why you have them.
We have Scottish Highland cattle, and we got one as our first animal because Wes has Scottish genes in him, and that was the breed of choice. We were just, he's a cow person, and so we got that in hopes of maybe milking her someday, trying to work her. You know, we had also just started the vegetable farm that year. And then it didn't make sense just to have one, so I got some sheep to go with the cow. So, and I got sheep because I'm a fiber person. I work with the fibers, and I spin wool and weave and knit.
Yeah, I saw the spinning.
Oh, the wheels?
The wheels that you have. So you do it again, all the old-fashioned.
Yeah, and you know, I guess part of that, and maybe part of the whole process of how we have chosen to live, is one of the things I've always been interested in is taking things to their original resource. I mean, really knowing where something is coming from the very beginning. So our food, I feel like that's what we've done in planting the vegetables with the meat. Now we have a dairy cow, a milking shorthorn, that was actually given to us. and I milk her, and just really, really knowing where all of our resources are coming from. And again, that ties in with the whole homeschooling process with the children, that I find right now what they're getting in that and learning in that is so in depth that their experiences are just really going to last for a lifetime, whether they or not they, you know, they, many people say they'll probably end up, you know, working in the stock market or whatever, but at least they're going to have this relationship or they're going to have these values. So we also, so we have the, we ended up getting Icelandic sheep, because they're a triple purpose breed for wool, and meat. They're super hardy, so they're not real genetically manipulated to be as kind of dependent on humans as some of these other breeds. And they are also a milk. You can milk them, which I've done very little of. But
to make cheese or to actually drink the milk?
Yeah, to drink the milk, make cheese, yogurt, and stuff like that. So since I have a dairy cow, I haven't really done
that. Sheep, cows, chickens.
And then chickens, yeah. And then the cat. And then we do have a Great Pyrenees, which is a guard dog for the sheep. We got it. It's also good with children, and we felt like they're old enough that they can be wandering off with the dog, you know, playing in the woods and stuff with the dog. And but I got it to you know, have a working dog on the farm with the sheep. But the but our sheep are incredibly independent, and I don't know why, but they really go after the dog and just will really whack her. So she's petrified of the sheep. So she tends to follow the cows around. And
we're back with our musical guest, Doug Little. Doug, tell us about your group, Charanga Tropical.
Charanga Tropical uses the unique instrumentation of three violins, flute, combined with Latin rhythm section. It was brought to Cuba by the French from Haiti and Louisiana in the 19th century and made famous by groups like Orquesta Aragon in the 1950s. This song, Chanchullo, is a classic from the repertoire and features myself on flute and a lot of terrific Latin and American musicians.
All right, this is Doug Little with Charanga Tropical, and if you want to hear more of his music, go to his website, douglittlemusic.com.
Cuando tú lo bailes, te divertiré. Chanchullo, chanchullo, bailemos. Chanchullo, gocemos. Dulce guayaba.
Now back to Ramsey and Patricia Adams on Like Mother, Like Son, interviewing Amy Gillingham, who's living off the grid.
Now, Amy, Michael Pollan has, there's almost a movement growing about how to address even, you know, global warming by eating locally. Is it, would you think it's possible to eat locally, I mean, from the year round? I mean, not for everybody, but let's just say for you. Are you able to?
Oh, we do. Yeah, we pretty much, well, the thing that we do buy in is our grain, but there are
grain
some
for the animals or for you. You
for
mean
us,
like flour
for our
and
flowers,
stuff, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
There are some local growers that do grow grain though, and they're, you know, grinding them a couple hours away from here. So I would like to start, you know, getting it from them. But yes, I mean, it's amazing how much you can do with just an underground root cellar, and
right.
again, you know, this is appropriate technology right here. It's not,
as long as you have the dandelion wine.
As long as you have the, you have a place to store your dandelion wine, and you have a place to store your vegetables. And it's kind of amazing, though, you know, just this underground room, and a lot of these old farmhouses had them, and now they, you know, put boilers and stuff down there, but so they're heated. But it was such a, it's such a great energy saver rather than refrigeration. Mm-hmm. And I store, we will make a lot of sauerkraut or kimchi or pickled beets or corn relish or lacto fermented foods and put them down there, and it stores all year. And this is what the old timers did, and also with their meats, you know, they would put them down,
salt them, yeah,
you know, or hang them in the attic. I mean, there's just so many ways that are really efficient ways of storing your food, and then plus all the vegetables. I mean, we store our, I mean, just to list some of them from the root cellar, the potatoes, cabbage, kohlrabi, winter radishes, carrots, beets, rutabagas, turnips, and then it's amazing how long, you know, the leeks will keep in there, and then collards and kale sometimes. I mean, if it's
so
cold enough,
really,
you really can store so
and
much.
And you're not talking about freezing. And you're,
right.
You're
and
talking about storing things in a root cellar. Mm-hmm. And just in case it sounds as though, although I don't think it does, that Amy and Wes live, you know, that their life is a hardship and sacrifice, I just want to say what we had for dessert, which was unbelievable. You had fresh cream from your that you had gotten, you know, when you milked the cow. You had blueberries, and you mixed that all together with some maple syrup. Mm-hmm. Was that about it?
Yeah, that was it.
And it was like ice cream. It was absolutely delicious and rich, and I loved what you said as you mixed it all together. We're not a low-fat family, and you are a family that celebrates and enjoys the fullness of everything. I don't see a sacrificial life there. It's full of life and wonderful things.
Do you have any sense of change in weather patterns being so close to the land, or do you not see that yet? I'm talking about global warming and...
Well, we started our vegetable farm in 1997, and so we've kept records of when we plant things out and the dates and, you know, over years, and just, you know, some of the temperature records, and we've realized that, you know, we've really our season has extended since we started by a couple weeks.
Which,
you know,
in
the beginning and a couple weeks in the end. In the last few years, we really haven't had our hard killing frost until, you know, almost the end of October, and it used to be more like the end of September.
Right.
So it's very interesting, and there's also certainly been the extremes. It's either really dry or really wet. And so, you know, this has actually been a little bit colder spring. Like, the soil temperature until recently was really still pretty cool. So, you know, it's definitely just feels a little more erratic.
Okay. Well, this has been really very interesting to talk to you, Amy, and hear about your life on
your
farm.
What's for dinner tonight? I'll be there at 7:30.
And it's great to know that you and your family are here in Sullivan County and living as you do. It's a great challenge and inspiration to all of us. So thanks, Amy, for talking to us tonight on Like Mother, Like Son.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Okay.
Visit us online at www.likemotherlikeson.org and let us know what you think of the show.
Good night.